And some people will say, I'm asking a lot from researchers. I'm actually asking them to think, can I be impactful? And not be naive that the only thing I need to do is just showing some optimal thing. That's all I can do.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Researchers want to maximize the development impact of their advice, and sometimes they get frustrated and disappointed when that doesn't happen. That means that their research not only has to be high quality, but if it's going to move the needle, it also needs to take in account the local political constraints, maybe, or even opportunities. So how can researchers or advisors do this? In the latest of our series about putting research into practice, I'm talking to Stefan Durkon of the Blavatnik School of Government at the University of Oxford. He's also head of the Centre for the Study of African Economies. Now, Stefan's got many years of putting research into practice, so he's the ideal person to be talking to about this. He joins me now. Stefan, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Very nice to be here.
There's a recurring theme in your books and your papers through the years. It's the gap between what's the first best, the evidence-based policy that we might all want, and what happens in the real world. What situations or contexts are creating those gaps?
Well, when we try to work with politicians, when we try to work with bureaucracies, with civil servants, I think anyone who's ever tried to do that will realize that the kind of objectives that we think they're pursuing, the kind of things that they try to achieve, is not necessarily the same than the ones that are publicized or the ones that we assume they are pursuing. As economists, we like to think that they want efficiency, that they want growth, that they want inclusive development, objectives like that. But then there's interests in a bureaucracy, there's implementation constraints, and not just about capability, because it's people's jobs sometimes depend on it, and maybe they won't want to put in the effort, or indeed there's political constraints, there's certain things you can't do. So I think we forget a bit at our peril that we are dealing with imperfection on the other side, as we would see it as economists, and definitely we would at our peril forget that they may well have other objectives.
Can we blame the researchers at all here? Is there any aspect of this which is about the quality, the type of research that's being done?
So at one level, I don't like to blame the researcher. The research does what research does and tries to answer big questions, answer small questions. They answer precisely, and they want to actually make a statement. Look, if we're trying to get development, this is the best thing to do. So I have no problem with that in itself. I'm actually sometimes wish that organizations I used to work for, like DFID or FCDO, wouldn't always ask that researchers should be policy relevant, because there is a point to research and to the questions. But the researcher that wants to have impact, well, has to think about how to achieve in the best possible way impact. So then just doing the research as if there are no constraints to getting to the actual impact sounds to me like very naive. And in fact, it goes against the way we would formally, as economists in any case, often think about it. You know, if there's a constraint, we need to take it into account and we need to think through it. How do we overcome the constraint, or how do we at least take into account? So I would blame the researcher that tries to say, look, I'm here giving you really policy relevant advice, and at the same time doesn't want to think about whether the political environment could actually even do it, or indeed whether the implementation capability could actually achieve the outcomes that we want to do. Let me give a very simple example. Forever, as economists, of course, we care about environmental impacts, we care about climate change, and we care about often about, say, fuel subsidies. You know, there's a very simple thing that fuel subsidies do not make sense from a social efficiency point of view. It doesn't mean that a country that has fuel subsidies has an easy route to get rid of them. In fact, we saw it in the UK. Once it felt a bit like it was a bit expensive for people, it's the obvious thing that we introduce. And apparently people told me that probably the amount of fuel subsidies we've spent as the UK is larger in the last 2 years than the cumulative sum on climate change mitigation internationally that the UK has spent in the form of aid. We do these things, and surely that's by no means optimal, but there's many countries that have these subsidies, and maybe we want to try to find a way of abolishing it. And many, many countries have tried in the past and failed because of political economy circumstances. And so there's no point and all the time keep on going on about it until we actually say, well, how would we think about building in our advice around fuel subsidies, a mechanism maybe by which we try to get rid of them in the situation that a country finds itself.
What other constraints or hidden objectives might we come up against? I guess if we're dealing with politicians, they always need to be popular as well.
Yes. And of course, we have endless short-term power games with politicians. Mm-hmm. So the politicians, they wouldn't mind if we had growth and development, but the first instance, they would like to be in power. And if you're in the opposition, you will look for any means possible not to do certain things. And indeed, you look for any way possible to stop the governing party to have some of these objectives. Let's go back to these fuel subsidies things. And actually, it's a really nice example, maybe an unexpected one, mm-hmm. which is actually from Iran. Iran was actually one of the first countries that successfully managed to remove fuel subsidies, 2012, 2013. Later on, they crept a little bit back in, but it did a massive, massive fuel subsidy fall. And the way it did it was not simply by keep on going on about fuel subsidies are bad. Everybody agreed to it. Fiscally, they were unaffordable also. Everybody agreed to it. But mm-hmm. the main thing that they knew would happen, if they were to try to remove the fuel subsidies, it would happen what it happened in lots of countries. Someone in opposition, and in this case, it's actually within the confines of what opposition can be. You know, this was reformers versus traditionalists. They would actually get some people on the street and make sure that the reformers would lose out and doing it. And so it's really interesting. So everybody knew, you know, the moment we're going to do the fuel subsidies, try to remove them, there's going to be riots and everything on the street. So surely we can't have that. Mm-hmm. So you had to find a way of overcoming that. And how did they do that? Actually, in a fascinating way, which is they did something which arguably is the second best. You know, you should just remove the fuel subsidy. That would be the first best. Mm-hmm. But they said, look, why don't we bribe people informally, bribe them, I use the word, not in the meaning that sometimes have, but we basically make sure people get a transfer to compensate for that. Now, a lot of countries have promised cash transfers to compensate for removal of fuel subsidies. Yeah. But again, there's a time inconsistency problem because nobody believes that you will give the transfer, or they're very happy for you to get the transfer, but then at the same time, the fuel subsidies can't be abolished. So how did they overcome that? In a way that there's no economic theory says that's how you should be doing it. What they managed to do is the central bank put a bank transfer on everybody's account, or at least 80% of the population, worth probably about something like half the value of the fuel subsidies. They put mm-hmm. it on their account, but with a little message. This will be released the moment Parliament votes the fuel subsidy through. The moment that happened, and everybody could see it was happening there, the fuel subsidy was abolished and they managed to do it. No one was ever in the street. No opposition politician could argue for it because people could see a lot of money. And so in the first year of the removal cost the equivalent of 2/3 of the fuel subsidies.
Right.
But they managed to find a way in a kind of a second best way. How do we do this in a way consistent with the way the politics works in our country? And so that's what I'm saying. Look, we need to become smarter in thinking our research, taking into account what would it take to implement it even in a political environment. And yes, and research that works on fuel subsidy, I will blame them, not try to think about how different countries could do it.
So let's think about what it means to be smart and to implement this second best, because clearly if something's second best, something has to be given up. In a recent paper, you've talked about how researchers could advise on what would be optimal if they're advising a politician to achieve both the development goals and those non-development goals as well, or even just to treat those political goals as just something that happens in another world and just ignore them completely. Is this a price worth paying? Because some of those non-development goals might be pretty unpalatable.
There will be circumstances. I think it is a price worth paying.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's think of the two extreme alternatives. I can give that first best advice and I can keep on going and shouting and stand there on the market square and saying, this is what you should be doing. I can do endless advocacy. Surely we should be doing. Surely the world should move to all these things and whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's many big issues in the world where, you know, shouting doesn't seem to be getting us very far.
Yeah.
So the first best advice may just be ignored because there's no route to get it ever implemented. Now, the other alternative, and I feel very sympathetic for civil servants, having been one in part of my life, but especially a civil servant where you deal with very obnoxious governments, and which is, I have done that part of my life as well, working here in the UK government, their objectives, they're not necessarily yours. Now, the civil servant may think, well, I just have to do their objectives. They are the ones in power. So in Nigeria, maybe I should make sure that I satisfy the objectives of some of that leadership. Yeah, okay, so I go to Nigeria. If I'm really going to do it, well, what is clearly an objective of some of the leadership? Let's not maybe condemn the current government, President Tinubu yet, or maybe not, but definitely in the previous one, it was definitely not trying to run the government well. Mm-hmm. It was a lot to do with making sure you stayed in power and had it. So, you know, if I'm then doing the first best advice to really serve the government's objectives, well, I could give them advice how to get your money in the Cayman Islands. If I follow their objectives, yeah, is what I would end up doing.
Yeah.
So put it differently and maybe in a more nuanced way, if these objectives are a bit less clean than you would like them to be, mm-hmm, you're a bit of a mercenary. Now, I want to find, is there another way of doing it than either stand on the market square, shouting and nobody listens, or being a full mercenary? If we want progress, shouting at the marketplace and nothing gets implemented, we don't make progress in development. If we be the mercenary, we don't make progress in development as well. Mm-hmm. How can we think more systematically about something else? Which is basically saying, look, I need to take as a constraint the political circumstances, the implementation constraints I'm facing, and I'll then try to do the very best I can do. Yeah, it's a bit of a slippery slope, but this is definitely better than the status quo and nothing happening. At least I'm giving advice that actually gets as much development going, given all the constraints in a country, rather than actually maybe nothing whatsoever happening in this space. So I think if we want impact, we need to take into account reality.
It might be very uncomfortable, though. I'm thinking of a situation in which, for example, you're giving policy advice, knowing full well that whoever's going to implement that policy advice will use it to benefit one particular political or ethnic group over another. Is that sustainable?
No. What I just described is a bit like what economists often call the second best. You know, you have a constraint you can't overcome. I'll now do the very best for development today, tomorrow, given this constraint. But you allude to something here now. Maybe it's okay for tomorrow and I'll get more children in school, but they're all maybe from one ethnic group.
Mm-hmm.
So you clearly need to think a little bit more dynamically. And I think the way I like to think about it is, well, can we even be smarter and not take in as given the political constraints?
Right.
Don't take in as given it and actually think through it. Okay, so what advice would I give that actually I'm trying to do, say, something in education, but build it in such a way that it's quite impossible to just favor one group or another.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, you begin possibly to shift that political constraint, that political economy constraint as well. So you make it, you know, as an economist would say, you make it endogenous. You make it part of the problem you want to do. I think, you know, and maybe this all sounds very abstract. It is definitely, and I call it in my paper, subversive.
Yes.
But it's maybe implicitly what we sometimes think we do. You know, we give advice about inclusive development, of how to reduce poverty, of how to reduce discrimination, how to improve norms. That's arguably in this. All I'm trying to say, if you give that advice, keep in mind, where do you have the entry points to implement it? Take into these constraints and then start shifting a little bit these constraints, these kind of political and implementation outcomes. And some people will say, I'm asking a lot from researchers.
Mm.
I'm actually asking them to think, can I be impactful? And not be naive that the only thing I need to do is just showing some optimal thing. That's all I can do. I do think, you know, and I've seen it definitely in action, we can do more. And in that sense, playing your part in society that hopefully we should be playing.
So from what you've seen in action, what type of researcher has both the knowledge, the political acumen, and the power to be able to pull this off?
So the power part, I'll come to it. The knowledge part, you know, there's a bunch of academics and researchers. They have big brains. I should expect them to be willing to actually think about the reality they're dealing with.
Yeah.
So I don't find it the excuse that they're not smart enough to think through some of these constraints. And especially, you know, I'm an economist. We are all the time trying to do the best given constraints. So we should be willing to do it, but we should take an interest. And this is a bit like taking the interest is part of this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm critical sometimes about, say, World Bank researchers or World Bank advice that comes, or IMF advice that comes. that actually behaves as if there's no reality where these proposals need to be, that they get mixed up there. And in fact, as a result, you get, call it third best, you don't even get the second best. To go back to your early example, you have a wonderful education policy. Yeah, the government takes it down and only does it for one ethnic group. Now, that's obviously not the best we can do for education and development. When we do applied research that we want to have impact and we give advice based on that research, I would expect a researcher to take an interest in the reality around them and not being the kind of technocrat that says, oh, nothing to do with me, it's not someone else's problem. Mm-hmm. We need to have judgment as well in that. And indeed, there will be plenty of proposals that come in or advice that comes in that are totally liable to the kind of capture that you described ethnically. So that one I would definitely put in the shoes of the researcher. You know, it's part of their stuff. The other part of it, you know, do they have the power? I'm conscious that they don't necessarily have it. Mm-hmm. But actually, the ones who have even less power are the poor civil servants working in a government that definitely doesn't want to be developmental. As outsiders, we often have far more, and as researchers, we often have far more freedom to say what we think and try to give the advice and so on. And I think we should try to use it. Yes, the entry points may not necessarily be there, but maybe the research can then empower someone within the system to actually do it. If we go back in history, we have plenty of civil servants, they say in India, Indian Administrative Service officers who have a relative independence that actually have the power to do quite a lot. So the best examples of things like that is often, you know, people help them to see certain things through. And I bet in practice, quite a lot of researchers do that, working with them and try to empower them and see whether we can help them to have the idea of how to work within their very imperfect situation. Giving them perfect solutions for their context is just unhelpful for them. I think we should empower some of the people who have a little bit more of the action power by giving them ideas that can actually implement.
Yes, I guess what I mean by power is to be in the room when these things are discussed. We mentioned in passing the World Bank and the IMF. You used to work for the government. You would have been in the room. Are you saying that the sort of conditionality that's common in these situations, that's not the subversive negotiation that you're looking for?
No. And there's a few things wrong with that. You know, the conditionality is usually the 10 first best things.
Yeah.
And then of that list of 10, anyone looking at that list and say there's three of them you'll never see. And then usually we're happy with the other seven. Hmm. And so, you know, we're happy with the relatively low hanging fruit, and that's under conditionality. I think there's a reason why sometimes fruit are low hanging, is that basically they're not very, very important. It doesn't really change that much. So it's not about having that first best list as we often get. You need to do, you know, think of IMF conditions, full capital market liberalization and all kinds of things, you know, the kind of extreme every state-owned company privatized in the next 5 years or whatever it is. And I'm not even talking about whether it's right or wrong, but it's that kind of list that you know is slightly illusory, where we know full well some of these things can't really be done. And where the attitude is, well, if we have a few of these, maybe we're already getting better. Actually, that's bad economics. That's actually not the second best, because the 7 out of the 10 done is not necessarily the one that will get us the best outcome if 3 of them are not done. You know, if 3 of them are the end of ethnic capture, yeah, and we can never do that, then all the 7 will just feed into more capture. And so it's more like thinking more smartly through these things. But at the same time, I really am a big believer in conditionality, because the only reason why powerful people inside the system will ever do it is that they need to own it themselves and they need to want to do it. So the more I think about it in also in other writings is maybe what we use research for, to find some of these people that where they have maybe some entry points and use this slightly subversively to make them stronger in the decision making. There's concrete examples, you know, there's plenty of places where you occasionally have an auditor general or a person responsible for tax revenue or someone in the Ministry of Education that can actually achieve quite a lot. By giving them advice, they can really act on it, that is realistic about the circumstances, you can strengthen them. And then you say, wow, these can deliver. They can actually even get maybe outside money in and so on and so on and so on. So it's not about a little list of conditionality. It is, okay, working with the grain, it's finding the people, the entry points you work with, occasionally having your nose a bit held, you know, there's some dodgy stuff will happen, but at least you're all the time thinking of that, you know, what progresses this now? You know, how do we get better people, more powerful in the government, people that indeed will use research better, that use the evidence better, and indeed generally are beginning to deliver on development in some of these places. So yeah, that little list of conditions with an odious government, you know, it's not going to get us anywhere.
Now, your frustrations down the years, we've spoken about this before, has often been around situations where we sort of know what the right thing is to do, but nothing ever changes because of these forces. We talked about it in the response to disasters. Is this something where we are just stuck, or are there situations, are there countries where some progress is being made with these political economy constraints?
I generally think we're making progress. You know? And on the bigger picture, I think that there are many more countries now than there were 30 years ago, where there's enough forces there that generally want to be judged by growth and development in their countries. We can go back to India. I mentioned it earlier. In the 1980s, it was still stuck. People talked about the Hindu growth rate. Poverty was something like close to 50% of the population in the most extreme way of measuring it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these days, all politicians try to win elections based on growth and development. I'm not saying it's perfect. There's a lot of things wrong in India, but that's a shift. You have things like that in Bangladesh, where they want to be judged by continuing the progress on growth and development. I'm actually tempted to say, like a place like Ghana, even though it's going in a crisis, it's very different from the 1970s. We have a lot of evidence from political science that politicians want to be judged by outcomes, and indeed voters respond to that. There is progress there. And I think this is not due to conditionality. This is not due to outsiders pushing it. But at least in some of these places, the outsiders, the international aid community, international organizations, have been at least responding to some of these changes in a constructive way. And in practice, they have condoned certain things that you say in the first best you shouldn't be doing it, but being realistic. And I think sometimes the researchers are a bit behind that curve. And this is the group that I want to appeal to in this context here, is that the practitioners on the ground recognize there are power plays, there are ethnic power plays and so on. And the good players, and I'm not saying organizations necessarily, but there's individuals working as outsiders there. It can be NGOs, it can be people in the World Bank, or in places like the IMF and in the bilateral donors, local civil society, all of these that actually find a way of working and pushing it forward. I worry a bit on the researchers that we said it's nothing to do with us, but we don't offer the best possible ideas for these contexts as a result. We need to be part of that adaptation. You know, there's a nice analogy here with science on seeds and fertilizer. It's not about getting the perfect seed in the lab. It needs to be adapted to the circumstances. And that's a big part of agriculture research, how to do that adaptation to the circumstances so that it can be taken up by the farmers. So it's a bit like that here as well, is that let's not just do as if it's in the perfection, but actually build in a bit of that realism around implementation and around political economy into the way we think when we try to have impact.
Let's talk directly to those researchers. A lot of them are listening to this right now, Stefan. Is it about changing the balance of research, the center of gravity of the research they're doing? For example, thinking more about ex ante policy formulation, less about evaluations, something like that. Is that what you're recommending?
When I was working in DFID, a lot of us fairly quickly came to the conclusion that there's plenty of quite reasonably good ideas on the shelf, but very few of them get implemented. So it's, first of all, we need to get into that implementation space. Actually, it's the same with the analogy with agriculture research. For Africa, there's plenty of things for a green revolution in Africa on the shelves of all these research centers. We just never found a way of systematically getting them adapted and adopted in the different places. So there's something like that as well. And so I'm, you know, I do RCTs. I should not saying this is these bad things. They give you lots of insight. Evaluations as well, evaluative research has definitely its role to play. And in fact, some of it is quite well geared towards this second best and not trying to give the best possible outcome. But something we've forgotten, I think, when I was working on the other side as a funder and trying to get things used, you know, you do evaluations not because you want to know whether something has worked. You do evaluations if you think there's an externality here from learning about certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, again, we don't build up enough thinking about what is that what we really need to learn. Okay, so there are certain things that maybe we need to think more about what some people call implementation science. You know, like how does it actually work when something gets implemented? So it's much more to do with being more careful about what is it that we should be learning that actually potentially can have more impact? So I definitely would, as we should study much more implementation and being aware of the kind of context of implementation to do it. The political economy part is probably a big part of that adaptation to get adoption, mm-hmm. you know? So we should maybe less obsessed with a lot of these first best things, but actually really think, what is the route to actually do this? So yeah, that's clearly ex-ante analysis. But again, we should be willing to learn this. You know, I would love to do, and I'm probably going to try to at some point design studies like, let's do in education department the first best version of something. Let's actually do it in a way that actually takes into account that teachers may not want to take this up because of all kinds of more structural and maybe even political reasons or whatever. And what would it look like then, even with the bosses and so on? And so actually build this a bit more in so that we learn a little bit more about these constraints to implementation. And maybe it will mean being a bit more open-minded and learning from other disciplines as well than just doing evaluative work and just getting a slightly more rounded view in terms of how can we actually get impact.
Specifically, are there any examples of research, types of research, areas of research that come across your desk and you think, yes, they're getting it, this is exciting?
There are definitely, and there's actually well-known examples of things that are touching on what I describe. You know, we have in education in Kenya, mm-hmm. there's of course well-known results from RCTs early on, and Michael Kramer and others, excellent work on introducing teaching assistants in school has an impact. There's at the same time a study that long time ago I was a little bit involved in helping to get it started, and two junior researchers at the time, now senior researchers around, Justin Sandvor and Tessa Bolt, also did on Kenya, trying to introduce this in government schools. This was initially done on NGO and then in government school. Now, it was amazing, even if you think of it, how hard they had to implement it. And my understanding is that even there were cases put by the teacher unions in the High Court in Kenya to try to block some of that kind of work. But in the end, they found the same interventions when it confronted with the government sector, they couldn't get it to work. They put it down to probably political economy constraints. Maybe they couldn't fully pull this down. But I think that definitely made us learn and saying, looks bits, be careful. Mm-hmm. And for example, people have learned from that we should be very careful in how we do research. For example, if you want something to be taken up in government schools, there may be lots of good political and implementation reasons to actually do it in government schools to start with and to actually work it. So you could get slightly different practice that actually really from the beginning thinks about how can I see this through. So that's an example, I think, of a pretty good and sensible way of going about it.
I mentioned at the beginning, Stefan, that you're head of the Center for the Study of African Economies, which is helping to build that research infrastructure to improve Africa's economic performance. If we want policies to be more effective, is there an argument that it's important to develop local research capacity and local researchers in Africa?
Yes, and irrespective of anything I've said thus far, it is important because it's not just that we want good researchers because it's right or something. These are people often that are closer to their own context.
Yeah.
And in sense for, they are more aware, they can be more aware of their implementation context, their political economy. It actually goes almost a second step as well. Most of them are teachers as well in their universities. Mm-hmm. And most of the civil servants that are condemned at times to a life of mercenaries, they actually need also to be well-educated and smart enough and help to think about alternative ways of thinking through economics, what second best could look like and so on. Mm. So it's not just because we want them to be good researchers and it should be owned in Africa. It's likely to be much better route to impact, but also because they teach so many of these people. And I think the worst that can happen, which unfortunately happens far too much, is that we've created an environment of very extractive research. Look, I have to be honest, my career is built on research on Ethiopia. I've captured my fair amount of rents from working on Ethiopia with Ethiopian junior researchers, but I'm definitely one that has captured an awful lot of these rents. A lot of the things we do, and that's not just RCTs, but also other kind of research methods, they're pretty extractive. So we should just be willing to say, look, this imbalance needs to be changed as well, and we need to find a way of putting some of our energy, especially those of us who benefited from some of these rents, to plow it back because, you know, we can't be as bad as the natural resource extracting companies. It's really something I worry about a lot. And also in the center in Oxford, we've been worrying about a lot. And in fact, on Saturday, 2 days from when we're recording this, we're off to Uganda, to Makerere University. And we have a conference where there's going to be 30 African researchers based in Africa presenting papers. It's probably the first time I go to a conference. 7 of us as faculty will be there, but not a single Westerner will present.
Wow.
We're sitting in the audience rather than lecturing them. We'll sit in the audience and we will give them comments and debate with them. Of course, we hope to help to improve their research as well, to actually go there and really start working with them at Makerere University. I think it's looking for ways of putting something back. And I think we've neglected that. It's not just about impact. Then it's also about fairness, that we need to find a way. You know, we've benefited from all these rents from it and finding a way of building up more of that capability there. And yeah, and for me, the main insight I had in recent times is, wow, they're teaching so many students. And they're the ones running these countries. And so it's not a few that go to Harvard that will come back. Yeah, they may be parachuted in to be finance minister one day, but this entire civil service are actually the people that these people need to train. So it's, let's at least find a way of helping them to be better researchers, giving them opportunities, and that way also making them better teachers.
Good luck helping them to meet that challenge. Good luck meeting the challenge yourself, Stefan. It's great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim.
So there's a couple of things you might want to read. Stefan's working paper from 2023, that's called The Political Economy of Economic Policy Advice, and that's published by the Center for the Study of African Economies. Also, his latest book, Gambling on Development, Why Some Countries Win and Others Lose, that was published in 2022. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, where we also have articles about the papers we feature.